CataractCoach.com podcast series episode number 131 with Dr. Claudio Trindade. Transforming a great idea into reality for patient care. Here's how to do it. Now, the invention he had here is this diaphragm or implant that you put in the eye, and you can put it in the bag or in the sulcus, and it's a pinhole. So it's the extra focus implant. It's 6 millimeters in diameter. It's used as a piggyback. And you can see here in this patient with keratoconus, it ends up giving a small aperture. It also is invisible to infrared, so you can still examine the retina and see right through it with infrared light. So here again, implantation is an IOL going in the capsular bag, and you can put in any lens you want, high power toric, high myope, high hyperope, whatever you got. Then you put the extra focus implant in as well, and this opens up. You can put it here in the capsular bag, and that is the new device. So what a brilliant idea, and here's his story of how he took it from just an idea to reality. Let's learn. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I have a very special guest who's going to teach us how to get something from an idea to an invention to have it in your hands in the operating room. And that is Dr. Claudio Trindade from Belo Horizonte, Brazil.
Hi, Uday. Thank you for having me.
What a pleasure. My pleasure. And I hope it is okay in the pronunciation. I'm still learning to pronounce the Brazilian words.
It's perfect. It's getting better over time.
Right. Now, for those who don't know, you had an incredible idea. When you were very young, you had an idea for your extra focus pinhole to treat irregular corneas. The idea was so great, you won many awards from it, including one from MIT. And you were also, in 2017, the youngest person ever to win the ASCRS Grand Prize Film Festival.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a very interesting story, I guess. Yeah.
Tell me about it.
One that I'm very enthusiastic about. I think that I enjoy talking about this because when I first thought about it, it was just an idea. And now, 12 years later, it's been quite a journey and a very interesting one. One of many learning, a lot of learning from it. And we gathered a lot of data over these 12 years. So it all began with a prototype back then with a three closed loop haptic design, and it evolved over with different models, and finally in 2016, it was CE marked with the two open C loops, and it's a very interesting concept. Let me just go over the basic basic design, and it's a diaphragm. It's a pinhole. It's an intraocular pinhole diaphragm. It's not really a lens because it has no refractive power. It's just a black implant made of a foldable black acrylic, which has a very interesting feature that I'll keep for later, of being transparent to infrared, and. The purpose is to be implanted in a piggyback configuration on top of a previously implanted IOL.
Okay.
And it's supposed to neutralize, to mitigate the impact of corneal irregularities in the visual in the optical system. So the main indications here we're talking about is keratoconus, post-RK, post-PK, and some other topographic imperfections.
Like trauma, irregular cornea from a trauma.
Exactly, pterygium, corneal laceration, and especially in those patients with a large pupil.
Right.
Because, and sometimes corneal trauma is followed by iris trauma. So that's a terrible combination of a irregular cornea with a large pupil.
Right, right.
Because, yeah, I see the pupil somewhat as a missing element in all the discussions we have. Usually when we're talking about irregular cornea, the pupil size is left aside. People don't really care about pupil as if everyone had the same diameter, which is not true. We're used to examine under very bright conditions, so usually most pupils will look the same, very constricted.
Right.
But in real life, it's not like that. And I like to say that the pupil is somewhat the gatekeeper of high-order aberrations into the eye in a perfect cornea. The pupil size pretty much doesn't really matter much, but once we have a topographic imperfection, pupil size does matter a lot. And the worst combination is to have a bad topography with a large pupil. So those are pretty much, so the extra focus was pretty much designed for that group of patients. Not presbyopia, not the holy grail of ophthalmology, like the IC-8 was pretty much developed towards the treatment of presbyopia in general, or pseudophakic presbyopia, if you call it. But we always had this patient in mind, those with irregular corneas, which are pretty much with very few options.
Right. Especially like sometimes here in the U.S. we'll say, well, it's a very bad or irregular cornea. Do a cornea transplant. But around the world, you don't have access to this much donor tissue. And so sometimes you may not have follow-up of those patients. You can do a cornea transplant, and in a few years, it's already failed.
Yes. Yeah. It's definitely not a perfect solution. Sometimes right. it's the only way to go, but we have a whole, I don't even think it's a niche now anymore, because it's a large group of patients with bad corneas, but corneas that might not be too bad for a corneal graft. And right. I'd say that they're mostly stuck to rigid contacts, and some of those patients really can't do it, can't wear them. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So it's
when you had the idea, what year was that?
That was in 13.
So this blows my mind how you can get an idea in 2013. Three years later, in 2016, European CE marked. That's amazing. I could never do that.
Well, I never thought it would go that way either. I mean, I thought it would be in fact, it was a very straightforward journey, because I'd say that mostly because these patients have very few options, and so it was really trying to hit an unmet need that was really there, and still is, in my opinion. And so the we learned a lot from the start. And I'd say that the key here is trying to find the ideal patient, ideal patient, because one of the, and I like to talk about the pitfalls, because that's mostly where people get in trouble here. Because since it's such a simple principle, and it's a pretty much straightforward procedure, people might overthink, or they might over rely on the pinhole for cases that are not ideal. So the ideal candidate here has to are those with a bad corneas, but still somewhat reasonable optical quality.
So maybe a lot of higher aberrations, but no big opacity in the cornea.
Exactly. Now, opacities are out of questions. In fact, right. If there's any central opacity, that's not going to work with the pinhole. But the point here, a tricky point, those patients with mild central corneal opacities, they'll still have a good pinhole acuity test beforehand. So if you place a pinhole occluder, for those patients, they will report improvement. And you will think that by having an intraocular pinhole, the result will be the same. And it's not. You're going to be, you're not going to enjoy the result for that.
Now, what's the diameter of the opening of the extra focus?
The extra focus has a 1.3 millimeter.
How do you choose this? How do you choose 1.3?
We went on, that was basically bench testing.
Okay.
And we actually had three prototypes, 1.3, 1.5, and 1.7 that we used in many different patients. But the 1.3 showed to be the most reasonable aperture for most cases, yeah. And we plan to have at least two options, 1.3 and 1.6. For different cases, for better corneas and more compromised corneas. but which is a similar aperture than the Aphthera lens that came after the extra focus. I remember presenting the first paper on this in Boston at the ASRS in 2014. And a year later, we saw the first papers of the IC8, back then manufactured by AcuFocus. And the AcuFocus IOL has a slightly larger aperture of 1.36. So it's actually 60 micron large, pretty much the same concept. And it might be interesting to maybe go over the main differences between the IC8 and the extra focus. What do you think?
Sure. But I have a question too. You have this brilliant idea. You work so hard on it. You make your whole PhD thesis about this one topic. You get worldwide recognition, win these big prizes, and then it seems like someone kind of borrowed your idea. That's kind of what it looks like from the outside perspective. I don't know much, but it's like, that's a little strange.
Well, I guess the first thing that I appreciate your words there, and I think that even before we start diving into that, it's important to give credit to those that came even before. So it's a very ancient principle. And back in the 60s, the famous Dr. Peter Choice presented a pinhole intraocular lens back in the 60s that was made by Rayner back then. So it is important to do credit. It used to be a PMMA lens with large incision, and it never really took off. But it's interesting to see a company stepping right over this previous work and pretty much this mentioning the different aspects of both implants.
Sure.
Although they're very similar, they do share some differences that I believe they're very, very important.
And tell us about those.
Yeah, I'd say that the first thing is the IC8 is a lens, not a diaphragm. So it's an IOL with refractive power, and it was developed, as I mentioned, with the purpose of treating presbyopia, which is the holy grail of ophthalmology. And in my view, this is absolutely out of question here with all the other more reliable options we have. And as soon as this implant reached market, we saw a shift towards more of a niche product to treat irregular astigmatism, which is what we've been doing. However, the some of the features of the IC8, it's just not suitable for that purpose, and I'll go over that. The first one is probably the fact that it requires a very large incision of 3.4 millimeter incision. That's already a problem, especially in post-RK cases, because you really want to keep that incision as small as possible to avoid the unzipping of the radio incisions. And another point is a very limited power range. It used to be from 15 to 27. Now they went down to 10 to plus 10 to plus 30. But it's still not the same as usually in keratoconus. Very frequently, you will need a very low powered lens. And in ProStar-K, you will need a very high powered lens.
Yeah.
And most importantly, you will need toric. You will need toric. So, and it's usually a high cylinder toric. So the one of the main advantages of having a third party pinhole piggyback option is that you can use pretty much whichever lens you need.
Right.
And you can use high powered toric lenses, which are a very good combination in specific cases of keratoconus, in post-RK, post-PK. So you really cannot do very well without a toric, without extreme powers,
right,
with a large incision. And with the extra focus, you also have the possibility of doing a secondary implantation.
Years right, and someone who's already pseudophakic.
Exactly. And also has the beauty of reversibility, which is much easier just to remove in case that the pinhole doesn't work well for that patient. So
there's one more critical thing, which I'm still waiting for you to say, which is the ability to look through it.
Yeah, exactly.
For an ophthalmologist to examine the retina unimpeded.
Exactly. That's the beauty of it. And I think that we can go into that right now. The black material of the extra focus has this amazing feature of being transparent to infrared light. And fortunately, we use infrared light in ophthalmology for decades now.
Right.
And so you can pretty much see through the extra focus with zero difficulty using infrared cameras, such as those that power many retinal cameras and OCTs and now even surgical microscopes. So you can see through it. And the IC-8 had a smaller mask, a smaller outside diameter of 3.2, as opposed to the 6 millimeter of the extra focus.
Right.
So you could dilate and kind of see outside of the mask, but right. That comes with its own problems, because once this patient dilates any larger than 3.2, which is not too large, that's pretty frequently you see patients with larger pupils, they will get light outside the mask, and that will cause glare, that will cause halos. So this possibility of seeing outside the mask comes with the price of halos. So in my opinion, it's better to block everything and be able to see through with infrared. Well, but that does come also with a drawback, the extra
focus. Which is what?
Because you should expect a very important reduction in luminance. So there'll be less light reaching the retina.
Of course.
There might be some dimming of the vision, some darkening. But that's where it's tricky, because one might argue that you're going to have terrible night vision and it's just not going to work. When in fact, that's not what we see. Those patients with keratoconus, they hate their night vision before surgery.
Right.
Because of all the scattering and the aberrations that they see through. So once you reduce the light entrance, they will get sharpness. They will reduce luminance. They will report some sort of dimming under very low light conditions, usually like a movie theater or at night when they wake up at bed. But during outdoors, like night driving, they report improvement in their overall vision, despite a sensation of darkening. So that's the point. If you choose the patient properly, the benefits will outweigh the drawbacks that do exist.
Is it okay to put it bilaterally? So bad keratoconus, both eyes.
Well, that's a good point too. It is, we have a paper published on that. We have a large series. First, I just want to remember what my experience looks like over these 12 years. We are almost hitting 600 implants now.
Wow, that's a great track record.
Exactly, over 12 years. So that's a very decent follow-up. And we have many bilateral implantations. And usually we try to not do it very closely. We do one eye and wait to see how patient will report darkening. And many patients come back and just they want to do the same thing, the fellow eye. We try to wait a little. And we in specific cases, we do go bilateral and with good results. There is a larger chance of the darkening becomes problematic. But on the other hand, there is an interesting thing. We had a couple of patients that reported that after the second eye, the dimming actually reduced.
Oh, interesting. Like ocular summation and
Probably because of the dark adaptation mechanism that kind of kicked in after both eyes are
for sure.
reduced. So once you had only one eye implanted, probably retinal sensitivity was not high enough because the dark adaptation didn't really set in. And after the second eye, the darkening sensation actually reduced. But we've had the opposite reported too. So this is kind of a Pandora box here, and you have just to be careful about it. Yeah.
Well,
And
that's a great track record. 600 eyes in 12 years is like one a week.
it is. It is. Yeah. That's
That's
yeah, we've had a very large series in all different scenarios. So pretty much everything. We even had a decent series of dissatisfied multifocal IOL patients, older versions that were complaining of halos and glare with multifocals with an open capsule that we actually performed the implantation to reduce the dysphotopsia with very good results too.
Now, can we in the pre-op area for a patient show them a pinhole occluder and say this is about what you're going to get? Or is that not accurate?
No, that is a tricky point, but it is accurate for the right patients. So I usually try to get a look if this patient seems reasonable. And first thing is the cornea still within a reasonable optical quality? So I would
Sure.
say any keratoconus below a mean K of 60 is considered if the cornea is transparent. So we're talking about very advanced cones here.
Right.
And the same for RK. And corneas in the low 30s are still reasonable. But anything below that or above 60, you have to be careful, even if the pinhole occluder shows a good result. Because in those cases, the results are not very good. So
Interesting.
within that possible candidates, yes, if you throw a pinhole on top of the best refraction, not just the pinhole, you have to perform a manifest refraction, try to find the best corrected vision, and then throw a pinhole on top of that. And that's what you expect.
That's very interesting. But yeah, I think you're right with those extreme corneas. Less than 20, more than 60. Yeah, it's
Then
going
you
to be
have to
way,
be
it'll be less
careful.
predictable.
Yeah, you have to be careful. But you can still find some good results outside that safety region.
For sure.
But yeah, but usually what but again, it's very important not to overly rely on the pinhole for the solution of the case, because the pinhole by itself, it's not gonna do miracle if this patient is way outside emmetropia. He's got a huge refractive error. You have to correct that and then throw the pinhole in.
So that's why you said you could choose any lens you want. Let's say for a
Exactly.
keratoconic patient, these ultra myopic, really probably single digit power IOLs,
Exactly.
toric if you need
Or
to.
yes, try to
So
do your
basically,
best to find your axis and then the pinhole on top of that. Special and the patients with larger pupils are the ones that, of course, are going to have a more impactful result because of the pinhole, because they're going from a very large inviting aberrations in
right.
pupil to a very strict gatekeeper, a
All right.
1.3 millimeter pupil. And so that's a good point. And I was always back then in the early days in 2013 when I was doing my corneal fellowship, and was just trying to improve my PK, just trying to find peace among all that PK cases.
Right.
The patients pretty much presented the solution, because if you go to a busy corneal clinic waiting room, you see patients squinting.
Squinting.
Yeah.
It's
And
true.
they can have the glasses. They've tried every
Yeah.
prescription. They've done many,
True.
many surgeries, but they still squint a lot. And that's pretty much that shows the power of the pinhole for irregular corneas. Yeah. So
that's amazing. So again, in general, you're trying to, let's say, debulk 90% of the refractive error with the IOL.
Yes.
And then let's say the remaining higher order aberrations, et cetera, you clean up with the pinhole.
Exactly.
Don't rely on the pinhole to do all the focus.
Yeah, don't be lazy with your IOL calculation. And we're going to have a pinhole in there. It'll take care of the rest. No, don't trust that. And don't trust that you will be spectacle free either, because right. You might need glasses afterwards. Yeah. And these patients are really happy if you find some glasses for them. It's not that they hate wearing glasses. They're used to only being dependent on rigid contacts. So if they have a prescription, they're not going to be unhappy about that. And so you try to, yeah, exactly. You try to go as close to ametropia. Actually, I usually try to overcorrect a bit, and I aim for a myopic result around -1.5.
Okay.
Because that'll give a very solid near vision without much compromise of the distance vision with the pinhole on top.
Right, because you have a larger depth of field focus with, yeah.
Exactly, sure. Yeah. And so usually I can even go further into the myopia here, into -2, and pretty much prescribe glasses for distance, and that's probably my go-to target.
Fantastic. Now, can I talk a little bit about the process? So every ophthalmologist I've ever met is smart. In fact, almost all of them are smarter than me. I always feel like I'm behind. But how do you get a great idea, which clearly this was a brilliant idea, and then how do you develop it, go through different versions of it, iterations of it, and then how do you finally work with a company to get it actually made and marketed and sold? What's that whole process?
Well, that's a very good point, and I didn't have the answer when I first started. I mean, I went with the flow here with my intuition and my and what I learned from it is that you really need a good team. You need good people around you to support that. And I found this with Mortier. Mortier was an amazing company for that. People
you just call them one day. You just pick up the phone and call Mortier. Hey, Mortier. Well, I'm doing surgery here in Brazil and I have an idea.
I did reach out to them, and I wasn't expecting any response. And they did reply back. And I went to meet them in Stuttgart in Germany. I wanted to have a one-on-one conversation with them back then in 13. And I did that, and they also presented a drawings of a somewhat similar design, but actually incorporated into the IOL from Dr. Vorosmarty from Austria back in the 80s. So I'm trying to give credit to those that really came before me. Peter Choice did, Dr. Vorosmarty, and I joined in 13. And Mortier presented the first prototypes. And we were very fortunate in ophthalmology to have video education. And that played a major role for me in this development, because I've always been very I put a lot of effort into my videos and my video production and the high quality imaging and the best as I can. So we did this since the beginning of this project, and we presented this with video all over the place. And much to my surprise, the feedback was very positive since the beginning. And
So 2013, you're a young doctor. You just finished your training.
Exactly.
You don't have any gray hair. In fact, you don't have gray hair now, but still, you're very, very young, and you can just go and meet with these.
Well,
amazing.
I didn't have gray hair. I didn't have much confidence either, but I did have. But I remember seeing those patients squinting,
right?
And I knew it was a nice principle, and I knew that the basis of overall it was very well accepted. It wasn't something out of the blue. It was a very ancient principle. And I think the idea has to be somewhat simple. And this is something that we can see in this development here. And I was very fortunate to have very good people around me. And I just want to thank and share my gratitude here to two doctors that really helped me along the way. One was Dr. Bob Osher,
who is the Godfather.
Godfather, yes, all of us. He really jumped in since the beginning. And also Dr. Mike Snyder, who is a genius, absolute genius. And I was very fortunate to be around them and to hear their feedback, which was precise, clever, and very well thought. And I guess I just kept trying to do my best. And especially in regards to patient selection, I mean, I talked to patients. I tried to extract as much data as I could. I was very determined in the examination, trying to find the right patient. And if I can summarize that, it's those patients with a reasonably distorted corneas, especially keratoconus. The best result are those in patients with keratoconus. And a large pupil, those are the ones that really, really benefit from it. So we have,
which is pretty common, because with keratoconus, at least the ones I see, they tend to be younger patients.
Exactly.
And they tend to have larger pupils.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I'd say that the bulk of irregular astigmatism, no doubt, is keratoconus. Post-RK, post-PK, and other sources are important too, but the bulk of it is keratoconus. But one problem is they have, and another point, they have a reasonably healthy eye despite the cornea, which is not the same with post-RK. Because post-RK are usually high myopes, they have floaters, they have retinal problems, way more frequent, glaucoma. They're more difficult because of that. They have
and they're older.
They're older. They have corneal fluctuations. So it's trickier. That's probably why we have better results in keratoconus, because of all that together. But this combination of a healthy eye, a larger pupil, a somewhat a steep cornea, it really gives a very good result with this combination. The problem is Those patients are young, and they have usually very normal lenses, crystalline lenses. So it's a big problem because you don't want to touch those lenses.
Right.
But given our experience and our long track record of great results in keratoconus patients and cataract, we moved forward into younger patients and doing clear refractive lens exchange for keratoconus in younger patients with keratoconus, in which we are out of options here, we are considering DALK. Usually we've tried doing something in the cornea, either cross-linking synthetic intrastermal segments, and now CARES. We have a large experience with all of that too. And some of the patients still requires contacts after all of that. So it's either DALK or this. Yeah. So this is a good option.
So I think it's an important point. These keratoconic patients, then you've already done something to try to stabilize the cornea.
Exactly.
So you've already done
not only stabilize, trying to improve the cornea.
Of course.
And despite all the improvement in corneal reshaping with CARES, and it's still there's still limitations to that.
You're still
going to have a regular cornea at the end, and we usually try to improve the cornea. Of course, it has to be a stable keratoconus, but you're still going to have a very large group of patients that still require contacts after all of that. In those cases, those patients that really can't tolerate contacts, they might do very well with a refractive lens exchange, a low-powered, maybe high-sealed toric IOL, and the extra focus on top of that. Yes.
Well, the nice part, too, of the extra focus is that you can undo it. It just is sitting there in the sulcus. It's easy to implant it, easy to explant it.
And a good point here, it began as a sulcus implant. the initial purpose was to implant it in the sulcus. But we actually now, whenever possible, we try to implant it together with the IUL inside the capsule bag.
Oh, interesting.
And that's for the sake of having better centration and overall stability. And one obvious question is there any risk of interlenticular opacification with two implants inside the capsular bag? And the answer here is no. We've published this. It's very easy to see that there's no interlenticular using an infrared camera. And the reason for that is because there's a space between both implants, mm-hmm. and the pinhole allows some aqueous circulation there that will prevent any interlenticular membranes to grow. And so whenever possible, we try to implant it inside the capsular bag together with the IOL. And it's a very versatile design because it is a larger diameter, 14 millimeter implant. But it goes very well together with the IOL inside the capsular bag with its longer haptics. They fold in and it works really well inside the capsular bag too. So it's very versatile in that sense that it can go either inside the capsular bag or in the sulcus. And this is very important because it's of course, we know with sulcus lenses, they tend to disintegrate way more than in the bag implantation. So yes, whenever possible, we try to use it inside the capsule bag.
That's fantastic. So how many different designs or iterations did you have? So you made the first one and then you made another one. And it keeps kind of evolving. How many designs until you have the final product?
Well, I was happy with this. I suggested this current design back in 2013. But okay. Mortier was reluctant and they wanted to do a three closed loop design. And we went with it. And it looked really cool. It looked like a boomerang out of a sci-fi right. movie. But it wasn't very gentle for the eye as a two open loop. So we went through pretty much four or five iterations and three opening diameters. And we actually... we had a 6 millimeter occlusive zone and a 4.5 millimeter occlusive zone mm-hmm. for this for the purpose of trying to examine the retinal periphery with indirect ophthalmoscopy, and with this 4.5, which proved to be kind of useless in that regard. It's better to go with the 6 millimeter and ideally have two or three ideal aperture sizes there. That's what we are sitting.
How did you find the special black material that with visible light, it's black and totally opaque, but when infrared light goes right through it and you can see it turns invisible. I didn't even know this material existed.
Exactly. I have a background in photography too. And okay. I was into infrared photography, which I'm not sure if you're aware of.
I'm not familiar. You'll
see some landscapes with some white trees. That's usually infrared photography. And this is not. But in infrared photography, you have a black filter, which is black. If you look at it, it's black, but infrared light is going through it. So I wanted to pretty much use that same concept in an implant and Mortier. Which has a very long track record of excellence in materials, developed that, and it was very perfect in the development of that. And that's kept under top.
And yes, it's really a neat idea. It really is. It's quite. We had a video on here from Bruno maybe a year ago, and a very complicated patient, and he put it in there, and then he showed examining the retina. Like, wow, I just couldn't believe that. It was as if it wasn't there.
Yeah, and you can see the toric marks behind the implant too. And you can use an auto refractor for that. Any equipment with an infrared retro image, usually auto refractors will do it. OCTs will do it. Retinal cameras will have it. You can see through it, which is it's a very neat feature. That's a very.
So if I have an ophthalmologist who's listening to this, a young ophthalmologist who has a great idea, how do they take this idea and further develop it and well, see if it's appropriate to make a product?
One point that I think is you have to keep or at least that the mindset that I used in this, you have to keep your expectations down, and don't really think that this is going to hit and it's going to be a big, no, the expectation is the mother of all anxiety and of all fear. So if you maybe a more laid back approach to that, and just to go with the first steps and see if you can go past the first steps and maybe reach a prototype, and then from there you can, and you have to be humble to see that you might you have to rethink your attitude and have a very critical mindset to what you're thinking, because you're going to have a bias. There is a confirmation bias. There is a confirmation, which is very important in aviation. That's where pilots kind of, they see things that feed their, they kind of read the same information, but they already have a conclusion in mind. And he's pretty much going to find the numbers that kind of justify his thinking. And that's really easy to get to see when you're developing something. You're gonna try to prove your idea is right, and it's not gonna work this way. It's not gonna work this way if you think your idea is right, but the numbers all show the different way. So you have to be critical of yourself. You have to be humble. You have to be inventive, and you have to pretty much have low expectations with it all. And do your best. Do your best. I'd say that at least this is my path. And try to avoid confirmation bias, because that's your number one enemy. That has killed many pilots flying. They thought they were right, but they weren't. And so it's a good way to approach this, I guess.
Sometimes it's hard for us to be open to criticism, because the idea, this is my baby, this is my idea, of course it's going to work, of course it's good.
Exactly. And you stick to that at with your entire strength, and it's not a good point. Yeah, it's not a good way to go.
Yeah, and then like finally, persistence. This doesn't happen overnight. In fact, I was so surprised that you could do it in 3 years, which is amazing, because to me, these kind of projects take way more time than that, many, many years.
Exactly.
And most of these ideas that we have, at least that I have, most fail.
Yes, not good. Exactly. Yeah.
They don't work.
Right. And again, it has to be a real unmet need. The principle has to be simple. It has to be commercially feasible. I mean, which is an advantage of the extra focus over the IC-8, because you pretty much have a third party pinhole. You don't have to have a set of lenses with different powers for a specific, for a very niche group. So this is another advantage. And but we also had a very large challenge along the way with the pandemic and with the changes in the European regulatory device regulations, which brought a large difficulty to many European companies. And Mortier is trying to overcome some of those challenges that are recent. And so that's something else. Yes. Again, it takes time. It's other people might have probably thought of it before you. Yeah.
Sure.
In my case, yeah. I'm telling you.
No, for sure. I appreciate how you're giving credit where credit's due. And, probably my most favorite part is you say, it's kind of what we tell our patients. You want to set reasonable expectations for the patients, but then as ophthalmologists with these ideas, we need to also kind of limit our expectations.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a good approach, not only to developments, but in life in general. I mean, sometimes you have to change route. Yeah.
You know, sometimes I like to, I have a funny saying. I said, I'd like to lower up my expectations. And then sometimes I'm just pleasantly surprised at the outcome. Like, wow, better than I expected.
Exactly. That's a good way to go.
So I think one more thing that we talked about just briefly, but I think it's so important is even at a normal eyes, we need to be checking pupil sizes better. So what I do in my clinic now, I have, as you know, you have a patient who comes to you with a 2 millimeter pupil in mesopic conditions. And this patient, you're not going to put a trifocal in. You'll never get the benefit of all the rings. But I think sometimes when we see the patient, if we either at the slit lamp, if they're not dilated, the bright slit beam means the pupils are tiny. And then a lot of times I'll come in the exam room, the patient's already dilated. So I
Exactly.
don't even know what the standard pupil size is. So that's why for all my cataract patients now, in fact, we get this auto pupil size of mesopic and photopic before anything happens to them, before drops go in.
Well, if there's something that I wanted the people to get from this talk now, it's probably this. So you really hit the nail on the head here, because pupil is still not looked properly, I'd say,
Right.
and it needs to be for every condition. And I'd say that a good way to go, a very practical way, that at least the way I do it, usually, I pretty much I just turn the slit lamp off, and just with the office lights, you
Oh,
can get
interesting.
a really easy way of doing this on the go, without any equipment. You get
Right.
at least superficial number for that pupil. And but it's, of course, in pseudophakia, if you have a small pupil, you have to. I've heard that senile meiosis is probably the only benefit of aging.
Well, because
I've heard that from mental.
you got to
Exactly.
counteract the loss of accommodation.
Yes, you have to take advantage of that, and it's still very overlooked.
Yeah, I think it became so important when I was noticing patients that I'd put in, let's say, like one of these new extended up to focus on like a Vivity, where there's a central 2 millimeter increased power in that, and the patient you aim for plano and they end up myopic. Well, their pupils were small to begin with. And that extra power zone means they're going to shift myopic. So now I know those patients, if I put that lens in, I better aim a little hyper, aim plus a half to nail plano.
I've watched that episode of yours of pupil sizing multiple times, and I really recommend for everyone that's listening and watching to go back there and see that, because that's brilliant. You really nailed
Only
it.
realize it after I'm like, wait a minute, why are these patients all ending up myopic?
Yes. And
So.
it's usually you realize later. You probably regret not examining before. Why didn't I just check that pupil before? And it's very common not to do it, or not to give importance to that. And
Right. I think
it's
for me, a
very
common one in
important.
my clinic is you had a pretty elderly patient, 80 years old plus, and they have this natural senile meiosis. So in the room talking to you, even in mesopic conditions, they are 2 millimeter pupils. And they
Yes.
come in saying they want a trifocal lens. And I say, no, let me just put a monofocal. Trust me, you'll be thrilled.
Yeah.
And then they're so happy. And they would have never gotten even the benefit of any of those trifocal rings or a few of
Exactly.
them.
Exactly.
So
And when you have a compromised cornea, the focus shifts totally to the cornea, which is right in front of you. So
right.
that's even less of a topic to check the pupil. So another key takeaway here is to double check your pupil in patients with irregular corneas, because it does matter.
No, yeah, it does for sure. I mean, these are obviously lessons we learned the hard way, but generally, it's funny when we first start off as a checking pupils, look for an APD. Right?
You're
Because
right, yeah.
every first year resident would check for APDs, but oftentimes not exactly documenting pupil size.
Size, yes, exactly. Yeah.
And so,
And
yeah, it's a
amplitude as well, not only the size, but how fast they dilate, and yeah. And yeah, it's a very important information to have, especially with the irregular corneas, and even in the decision making, the decision of an intraocular lens for cataract. Yeah.
Right. So, like, another good example is, so I'm minus two, and I often just walk around without glasses. And then people are like, well, how can you just walk around with no glasses if you're minus two? I was like, well, you know what? I actually had my own pupils checked. And I have relatively small pupils. So to me, it's just not that bad. Minus two is pretty good.
I'm sure it plays a role, that small pupil there.
Right.
It does. Well, if it didn't, it wouldn't be important in photography. Photography, the diaphragm is a major.
Aperture size is everything.
Yeah. So you have to have control of that. And so it is a very important point to keep in mind, pupil size.
Yeah, it made a huge. I was recently in a video for our sister channel, Retina Rounds, of how to do a dilated, depressed peripheral retina exam. I was the patient. I haven't had my retinas checked in a while, and I'll be your model. I'll be your patient. And so I had my retina guy examine me, and obviously I was dilated. I couldn't believe how much worse my vision was.
Yes.
Exactly. It was terrible. And then minus two felt like a real disaster.
That was probably a very learning experience for you.
Right. and luckily, my retina periphery is okay.
Yeah, exactly. And imagine if you have an imperfect cornea. That's even more, more important. Yeah. And so it is the iris is a very important element of the eye. And the pupil is also a very important point to be considered.
So let me sum this up here. Let's do an example of a patient. You got a patient who comes to see you, let's say 50 years old. Mm-hmm. Patient's 50 years old, has keratoconus, already had all the treatments done, had some cross-linking, had some cares, had okay. And they're wearing a hard contact, which now that they're 50, they can't really tolerate anymore. Mm-hmm. So the vision's, they come in, the vision's terrible. And how do you decide what to do?
Well, usually you try to perform a good manifest refraction. And we in Brazil are fortunate to do our own refractions, which is not, I wouldn't say it's the most pleasant experience, but at least it's important.
That's a hard refraction. It is
very hard.
Exactly. You ask them better one or two, they say, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually more of a refraction range than a refraction itself. And usually I try to reach at least 20/80 or 20/100 with the best correction. If it's somewhat below that, it's a red flag for me. This might be too compromised. I usually aim at around 20/100. Try to reach that with any refraction. If you get a -8, -6 still, that's what we're talking about here. And it's usually those prescriptions that are pretty much impossible to wear, a -8, -6 still.
Yeah, it's impossible.
Yeah, it's impossible. It's pretty much uncorrected or rigid contacts. And but still, they benefit from -8, -6. That gives an estimation that the cornea still improves. Otherwise, if it's a very advanced cone, you can try. It's not going to get any better with a refraction.
Sure.
So if the patient goes from, say, 2800 or 2400 to 2080 with a very, very,
they'll do great refraction. Then on top of the refraction,
on top of that, I throw a pinhole. Usually those patients smile and say, oh, now I can see. Can you prescribe that to me? Can you do that? I said, no, I can't, but we might have something better. And those patients are the ones that I consider doing a refractive lens exchange or a cataract surgery. Usually they don't have any cataracts, and I'll do a refractive lens exchange either with a toric or a non-toric. That's a separate chapter.
Sure.
And
would you do the non? Let's say their eyes are almost the same, very similar. Would you do the non-dominant eye first, or doesn't matter?
I think with advanced keratoconus or moderate keratoconus, this dominance is really not playing much of a role here, right, unless they wear contacts and you can really tell. I usually go with the ones that I expect the better results here.
Sure.
So I try to go to. I really try to take care of low order aberrations with the IOL, and I really try to do my best with the power calculation with keratoconus specific formulas, and I usually aim myopic. I'd say -2, and then I during surgery, I'll do my pretty much routine surgery. 2 points here, I try to, of course, do a capsular polishing at the end to try to prevent, since this is a younger patient, I always do that, but especially in younger patients, I try to do this. I usually place a suture at the end of case. Cornea is biomechanically
unstable. Yeah,
unstable, and we place both implants inside the capsular bag. And usually, my expectation is to have a very reasonable expectation. And we're talking about here patients in their high 50s of mean keratometry. Okay. So we have hundreds of patients who ended up 20/40 J1 uncorrected.
Wow, 20/40, that's amazing.
J1 uncorrected, but hundreds of patients like that. And with a negative prescription, I'd say -2 over this slight cylinder, you might even improve to 20/30. So wow. We don't see this very often with DALK.
Right, no, almost never.
And it's filled with its own complications.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's an interesting alternative. It's something still, and of course, we try to do our best to make the cornea as best as possible before surgery. And so this is my ideal case. It's what I think over the years, what I found more impactful with the pinhole. It's not the patient with normal corneas and trying to improve depth of focus and trying to just go with the trifocal or do your best and whatever. It's not presbyopia. RK, they're also good candidates too, but they're trickier. But in keratoconus, eyes are healthier, eyes are shorter.
Right.
Retinas are better, and they usually do very well. You have to have a retinal partner near you to give a green flag for that.
For sure.
And take care of retinal issues beforehand, if there is any. And to assess the risk benefit here.
Now, when are we going to have this access in the U.S.?
You actually have access in the U.S. And right now, yeah. But as a compassionate use device.
CDE, compassionate device exemption.
It does take a lot of work to fill all the paperwork, and I'm not sure when it's going to be FDA registered for. But as I mentioned, Mortar is trying to overcome some of the regulatory issues that arise in the past few years. And it should reach the U.S. sometime in the future. I don't know when.
Awesome. Well, like you said, just keep reasonable expectations.
Avoid confirmation bias. I'd say that this is the main thing. Don't examine yourself, not only the patient, but examine yourself and your
own biases. Yeah. No, that's for sure. That's a great point. Well, I want to thank you. I can't believe we've been talking for an hour already. Time flies when you're having fun.
That was amazing.
I'm going to put a link down below for your implant, also your website. And if you have a great video you want to share with us, we're happy to feature that video too. Just send it on over. And again, I want to thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Yudai. You're amazing, amazing reference for all of us.
We're all learning from each other. That's the best part. And if you're a young ophthalmologist out there listening and you have a great idea, run with it. Do it. Follow in Claudio's footsteps. Think about it. Do this. Do the research. Have reasonable expectations. But definitely pursue it. You can do this. I promise you can.
Well, yeah, that's a good message. Yes.
Fantastic. So, I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new podcast every single Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Everywhere you find podcasts, you find the Counter Coach podcast. Plus, of course, we have a new Counter Coach video every single day. And check out our sister channel, Retina Rounds, which also has not only those videos, but also the Retina Rounds podcast every week, too. So until next time, I'll catch you later.